Let me start off by offering two apologies. The first is that I do have a manuscript, so I won't be talking without one, which is what I prefer to do. So you'll have to suffer me sitting here with my head bowed. But the other apology is that I may be here under false pretenses, since I do not claim there's much philosophy in my remarks. I like to think of them as biographical and philological. But then, of course, at the end of a long, tiring day, you may be pleased to be offered some simple-minded remarks. So perhaps it's going to work out very well. I've called the talk, while reading Wittgenstein, Philosophical Investigation 1-2, the first part of 19, which you have, but something that has slipped out is the addition, A Cautionary Tale. What a tale is a caution of, I hope will become clear. A strange thing happened to me a while back. Idly looking into the latest edition of a Norwegian translation of Peer, for once having the text as a handsome book, it struck me how odd the first paragraphs are. This I was not prepared for, having had my reactions to the work formed while a very young student. My teacher, Jakob Mæhle, used repeatedly to spend long hours with us over the beginning of the book, setting out in great detail the various early language games, and more than anything else, filling out details in the shop example, always earnestly and always in an even insistent tone, as I recall. It was as if Wittgenstein had revealed a wondrous explanation of our ordinary day-to-day linguistic behaviour, an explanation now passed on to us. 13 years ago, I gave a talk to a French-Norwegian conference, much like this one. Two main points of the talk were, first, that unlike the Tractarian view of language, Wittgenstein's PU view was incomplete in the sense that linguistic meaning, that is, the existence of meaningful languages and language users, was not accounted for, even though that seems to be what the later view can be read as providing. Specifically, I criticized the opinion that the concept of language game provided such an account. My claim was that a verbal string could be introduced and drilled in as part of learning a game, without thereby becoming a meaningful string. Just think of cases of nonsensical rhyme. Secondly, I suggested that what was needed is a biological element along evolutionary lines, so that the possibility of specific meaningful utterances were tied to our natural aptitudes and needs as a species. I proposed the work of Ruth Millikan as directed towards that purpose. Without arguing the point, I treated PU's statements about language as statements about human language. None of my listeners challenged that assumption. Needless to say, the talk was not well received by some we may call, echoing a famous dichotomy, the right-wing Wittgensteinians. Times have changed, however, so perhaps it is no more acceptable to take a critical look at an issue connected to my previous talk, namely the status of some concepts introduced in the opening paragraphs, which are the ones I'm going to talk about. Specifically, I believe the time has come to bring to the forefront the assumption in my previous talk. For the truth is that early remarks in PU detach the concept of language from the concept of human being. Now, I'm not saying this is wrong in general, or that we should read the text as saying those two concepts belong together. Clearly, we cannot do the latter, since Wittgenstein says that animals may have language. But I am saying that when constructing or imagining a language, it is natural and necessary to ask who or what can have that as a language. I am also of the opinion that readers, by and large, assume humans to be the users of those early language games, and in doing so, may be reading too much into the text. Even though commentators have objected to some parts of PU, most have treated it with great respect, almost reverence. The main conclusion I draw is this. PU is, in early paragraphs, quite an obscure or ambiguous piece of philosophical writing. Surprisingly so, given that Wittgenstein endlessly fussed over it, leaving behind page after page of slightly different formulations. In order to substantiate this verdict, let me start at the beginning, which is, of course, the discussion of Saint Augustine. Wittgenstein seems to think of the passage quoted in paragraph 1 as expressing what Gilbert Ryle once called a fido-fido theory of language. Words are proper names standing for objects. Such an image of the nature of words fits well an idea of objects as more or less middle-sized physical objects cluttering space around us. Since Wittgenstein further claims that this picture sees sentences as combinations of such names, couldn't he find one who held such a simple view, apart from the awkward version we find in the Tractatus? For Augustine himself does not hold the view, as is clear from the quotation itself, and now I'm quoting parts of it. Thus, as I heard words repeatedly used in their proper places in various sentences, I gradually learned to understand what objects they signified. End of quote. In their proper places, this means sentential structure. Minimally, a word can play different roles. Maximally, there are different types of words. What objects they signify. This can be fairly innocuous. Augustine talks of signs, a traditional way of conceiving words, in a tradition running from Aristotle to Condillac, at least. Wittgenstein himself, in 13, paragraph that is, talks of what we may call the innocence of using the word signify. How little is said thereby. Traditionally, all terms that are in the category signify, as Aristotle would say. The exceptions to the categorical terms are the syncategorematic expressions. Frege, who held that all sentence parts reached through analysis bedeutet, explicitly says that not all bedeutet objects. The difference between him and the tradition may be different opinions as to what it takes to be an object. It is also of interest to notice that Wittgenstein, in the first paragraph, writes on names for actions and properties. And later, in paragraph 15, he is curiously insensitive when he states that names typically work as labels attached to things. If you think of sticking labels on objects, labels such as these I am about to mention are common. Black and Decker, to be fetched tomorrow, needs seasoning, £5 to pay, half price, hardly a name among them. In paragraph 32, Wittgenstein expresses a far better insight into what Augustine actually thought. Holding the view that language is given us by God, and that men cannot teach us to speak, that is, to be creatures using language, Augustine had a subtle interest in difficulties of expressing the same thought in different languages, a fact we can detect from his developed interest in problems of translation. So perhaps Wittgenstein did pick on Augustine because Augustine held a view on the origin of language that Wittgenstein thought false. This is an issue we see as different from that of language acquisition in children. The quotation from St. Augustine in itself expresses something perfectly acceptable as a description of how children master words. That is also Wittgenstein's opinion. What he objects to in the passage is the iffy thing of going beyond this and attempt to give a general theory. Wittgenstein says that the Augustinian description fits the way children learn to speak, which is exactly what the quotation claims, given that Augustine would mean learning to speak that particular language. It is important to have one thing clear. Wittgenstein is not denying that the Augustinian description is a description of a language, a possible language, whatever that means. Wittgenstein does not specify requirements. What Wittgenstein says is that the picture does not capture the essence of human language. What he should mean on a reasonable reading of his remark is that the picture quoted tries but fails to describe the essence of any human language. His further complaint is that the description does not fit our language. It's not clear what our means here. It cannot mean one among the ones we have. Nor can we say that our means only. Perhaps he is thinking of a first language, Muttersprache, which word occurs in paragraph 7. The concept of first language and natural language, such as English, German, etc., seem absent from the beginning of Pew. Anyway, as he says, the description of paragraph 1 is a description of a language more primitive than ours. It fits a language, but one more primitive than ours. So Wittgenstein sees languages more or less as ranked according to primitiveness. His concept of primitive language goes together with some other terms characterizing languages. I shall now turn to that. Throughout the paragraphs, Wittgenstein varies between talking of language and talking of use of language. Now speech acts are in focus, no words, with no apparent attention given to the contrast. Think of his line that the languages in paragraphs 2 and 8 consist of orders. This statement in 18 carries over into discussion of the notion of a complete language. Wittgenstein develops the idea of a complete language, giving as an example what we find in paragraph 2. The language there is a complete primitive language. So complete and primitive are two important concepts. Another one is whole, ganze, used in paragraph 6. Wittgenstein talks of something being a whole language. I believe Wittgenstein means that the whole language of someone, a person or a tribe, is always complete, no matter how primitive the language is. Whole here means only or total. There's no limit to how primitive or simple a total language, the only one had, may be. Wittgenstein compares in 18 a language to a city. As cities may grow, so may languages. They may be added to. This idea is very different from the logician's idea of conservative extension. Languages, according to Wittgenstein, may be extended non-conservatively. His plausible view is that all languages are logically incomplete in the sense that they tolerate a non-conservative enlargement. An ordinary language is never a finished product. Speakers may add to the language in ways which make possible sayings not previously expressible. At the same time, we cannot use this possibility of enlargement as a proof that a language is incomplete until the enlargement has taken place. That would lead to the conclusion that no language is ever complete. Whatever Wittgenstein meant by complete, it is not what the logicians mean by a complete system. A language for Wittgenstein is definitely not a complete system. A language does not get more complete by extending its range of possible sayings. That opinion is fine, seems very reasonable. To be complete does not mean that added pieces replace missing ones. His position can be put in a couple of catching phrases. Completeness is compatible with possibilities for enlargement, and only language is never incomplete. But his way of thinking about complete primitive languages goes the other way. Take an ordinary natural language, remove parts of it, keep going until only a small fragment is left. This fragment is itself a complete primitive language. Fragment here means just a few words and a few occasions on which to use them. So we have two very different ideas. The first is that we may enlarge any given language. The second, the problematic one, is that we may take powers of expressiveness away from a language, and whichever way we do this, the leftovers are still a language. In the text we are looking at, Wittgenstein doesn't state either of these opinions in those words, but he expresses closely enough the first with a metaphor of a city. And his notion of complete primitive language is not licensed by this first idea. It is the second idea, the one where we take away expressiveness, in one form or other, which is required here. That idea drives the construction of very simple linguistic exchanges, claiming that the verbal exchanges with whatever resources are used make up a complete language. And that second idea is unreasonable, which we see when asking who has the fragment as their only language. Remember that when we enlarge a given language, the natural habitat of doing this is with natural languages. We see that it's natural to think it possible for us to increase expressiveness. And the reduction of expressiveness also typically seems to make sense when we start out from a human language and imagine ourselves shedding parts of it, however well we understand how far that may go. But there comes a point when we have to ask, could this be an only language for us? Or can we picture the creatures using this? We must tell ourselves that the important test as to whether we are dealing with a possible complete language is if we can see any kind of creature having that as their only language. We must further tell ourselves our interest is in human languages. And Wittgenstein's characterizing judgment on the examples in paragraphs 2 and 8 is not convincing when they are seen as specimens of human language. The natural conception of them is to see them as isolated cases of language use in odd circumstances, a very different idea. When Wittgenstein says that the builder's language in paragraph 2 may be a complete language and the builder's whole, total or only language, it is tempting to press that claim. Do they speak only those words and only while building, or is it possible that when the lads knock off from work and come home, slab means what is for dinner, and later in bed, slab means not tonight there, I have a headache. Wittgenstein sets up the example in such a way that we are supposed to know the sense of the word slab. It is our word, after all, that is used by the builders, isn't it? But unless we know the range of use for the word slab in the builder's language, we do not know what word or words slab is in their language. Their slabs might not all be our slabs. Used the way Wittgenstein describes, their words are not ours. Wittgenstein is quick to say things like, we can or could imagine, or let us imagine. For example, we can imagine a language consisting entirely of orders. Well, can we? Wittgenstein, of all people, ought to be, and in other places is, aware of the pitfalls here. See paragraph 395, where he says, there's a lack of clarity about the role of imaginability in our investigation, namely about the extent to which it ensures that a proposition makes sense. We do not imagine something just by saying, yes, I am imagining or picturing it. Imagine pigs flying. Yes, yes, I picture a fly now up there, a pig now up there, flapping its short legs, propelled across the sky by powerful gases exploding from its behind. It's a short word for that long phrase I use, but I shan't give it. As Hegel says, we have to distinguish between real possibilities and superficial ones, the latter expressed by non-contradictory sentences. There's a difference in credibility between saying, I can learn some Italian, and saying, I can jump over the moon. When Wittgenstein says that we could imagine the language in paragraph 2 being the whole language of A and B, this leads to one conclusion. If such a primitive language as that in paragraph 2 could be a complete language at a whole, that is the only language of A and B, the total and only linguistic means at their disposal, then they are not humans. Here's the argument. The first premise is that the imputed Augustinian language description, call it Yald, doesn't fit the human language. The second premise is that Yald fits Blit, the builder's language, in two. From those two, we get the dilemma that Blit is not a human language. From the third premise, Blit is or can be conceived as a complete language. And premise four, Blit can be conceived to be the only language of the builders in two. And premise five, human beings who speak a human language, whatever else they speak. Human beings who speak have a human language, whatever else they speak. From this we might simply conclude A and B, the builders in paragraph 2, are not human beings. The first three premises come more or less directly out of Wittgenstein's text. The fourth, is a reasonable consequence of his claim that the language in 2 may be the whole language of A and B. And the fifth premise I consider a necessary truth, and it's not necessary thus to find it in the text. This is what the text permits us to conclude, unless we take Wittgenstein to make a modal claim. There are no human languages as primitive as that in paragraph 2, but there could be. That is, unless we read the first premise as Jald does not fit any existing human language, but it is a description of a possible complete human language. And this reading expresses what would be a very odd claim to make by Wittgenstein. A claim I also believe is false and aim to undermine. The conclusion of the argument, I wager, is deeply counterintuitive to most followers of Wittgenstein. I shall later turn to a surprising exception, one that can be said to provide philological support for the above conclusion. Most readers probably conceive A and B as some esoteric types that could come out of a habitat such as a Polynesian island. But if A and B are not human, what are they? Well, in paragraph 25, Wittgenstein admits that animals may use very simple, primitive languages. So we might ask Wittgenstein, are you really of the opinion that animals can use language, that is, play language games? So let me now turn to the notion of language game. If the Augustinian view of the uniformity of words is mistaken, what should replace it in Wittgenstein's view? Quite obviously, an account showing the various ways in which words do mean, in other words, how they function in language games, and how this functioning shows up the differences among words. Wittgenstein needs to bring forth the actual uses of words, and then we see how they contribute in different ways to meaningful sayings. This puts a heavy explicatory load on the concept of language game. So let us look at that notion. Wittgenstein explains his meaning in paragraph 7. He there gives 4 different cases of language games, plus 2 simpler processes, as he says, resembling language. One case, or the first account, is the whole process of using words, as in paragraph 2, to learn one's mother tongue or native language. That's where Muttersprache occurs. Secondly, the case of 2 considered simply as a primitive language, whatever that is. 3, he also will call language games processes of calling out names, as in Ring and Ring of Roses. And fourthly, a whole consisting of language and the actions into which it is woven. It is strange that such a central notion is given such a disjoint account. The cases of 1 to 3 we may understand more or less, but 4 is different. What it could mean to say that the whole consisting of a language and the actions into which it is woven, what that could mean is difficult to fathom. At the same time, 4 gives the most complex sense with the widest ramifications. My guess is that most readers use a 5th sense of the word, or a 6th, or for one such sense, we could go to 130, where we get the remark that language games are set up as objects of comparisons, which are meant to throw light on the facts of our language, by way not only of similarities, but also of dissimilarities. One natural question to raise at this point is, How does Wittgenstein see the relationship between language and language games? Rush Rees has a very clear opinion. I quote, Wittgenstein says that any language is a family of language games. This comes from his book Discussions of Wittgenstein, page 73. Rees doesn't quote Wittgenstein as saying this, but it is a reasonable attribution in view, for example, of this. I know I'm quoting from paragraph 261. An inarticulate sound is an expression only as it occurs in a particular language game. And no quote. So, any language game is at least a part of a language. If it is only a part, what can be added so that we have a language? It seems that the only reply we can give is other language games. Therefore, a more normal human language is a collection, or as Rees wants it, a family of such games. Rees considers this a weak point in Wittgenstein's philosophy, since it does not account for the unity a language has. As a general observation, one may say that Wittgenstein does not impart to the reader any feel for why a particular language game exists. Why would any language user behave in those ways and not in others? It is no defense here to say that he need not answer any why question that he is only describing. It is precisely his description that is in question. I shall now turn to the notion of Lebensform. If the notion of language game does not seem to provide much in the way of making us understand how we come to be language users and how we use language, what about Lebensform? After all, paragraph 19 links Lebensform directly to language. The word Lebensform occurs 5 times in Peru, according to the index in the bilingual editions. The first comes in paragraph 19, the second in paragraph 23, the others are 241 and 2 places in part 2. Joachim Schulte, in his Variorum edition, lists 6 occurrences, but the 6 to paragraphs 3 to 5 is an error. So here are the 5 occurrences in the English Philosophical Investigations, but leaving the German word in. First we have paragraph 19, and to imagine a language means to imagine a Lebensform. Then 23, the speaking of a language is part of an activity or of a Lebensform. 241, that is not agreement in opinion, but in Lebensform. That is, to agree in language we use is to agree in Lebensform. I have a footnote here saying that the distinction between agreeing in opinion and having the same language, which is exactly what that quote gives, is a difficult one for Wittgenstein to make, since he requires for a word to express or have a meaning that it is used in a language game where it presumably is employed to express a particular opinion. The last two occurrences are the phenomena of hope and modes of this complicated Lebensform, and what has to be accepted the given is, someone can say, Lebensform. The old translation by Anscombe translates Lebensform as form of life. How are we to read these occurrences? Given what we have been led to understand previously, Wittgenstein is asking us in paragraph 19 to look upon the existence of the totality of particular language games played by the same language users as the existence of a Lebensform. If so, how are we to understand the word? And now I'm entering into the heavy philological part. Both my two recent German dictionary, Duden and Warig, give Lebensform two sharply separate meanings, the same as the word Livsform has in Norwegian. One is what I should call the biological sense, using the word as a general term for kinds of living organisms, roughly the same as the word species. The second sense, or rather set of senses, is roughly way of life or way of living. For this second sense, both German and Norwegian have alternative words, e.g. Lebensweise, Lebensart, and Livsførsel, Levemåte, respectively. Both languages have a variety of words in this area, with subtle differences. The second sense in both languages is open to a wide variety of interpretational slack. At the minimal end, we have what the English would call lifestyle, e.g. healthy, vegetarian, sporty, alternative, etc. One may try to picture or build up a maximal sense, providing what some philosophers call a thick concept. In this case, an anthropological one. What this would be is less than clear. My guess is that most readers of PU have a more or less developed idea of such a maximal sense in mind when they come across Lebensform. Wildhagen, in his German-English dictionary from 1953, has only one entry for Lebensform, which he translates as life pattern. The sense is clearly the biological one. Wildhagen did his work from the 20s on and died in 1945. We should be careful about judging how far people are moulded by their time and their culture. Until one knows the minds and capabilities of the language users, one cannot say which transgressions are within their ken. The dangers of attempting to use the word such as Lebensform with a thick lifestyle sense are twofold. It is open to more or less easy readings, with an added danger when coupled with sentiments such as Lebensform being the given, what has to be accepted, constituting bedrock. His opinions thus interpreted make Wittgenstein so sound like a glib philosopher of culture. Noted a piece of philological support mentioned earlier. At the end of her life, Anscombe did some revisions in her translation of PU. Since some mistakes were not corrected, she may have left the revision work unfinished. But she made one change which ought to cause alarm bells to go off for many readers of Wittgenstein. In the first two occurrences of Lebensform, those in 19 and 23, she changed her translation from form of life to life form, that means life-form, leaving the last three alone. Regrettably, the index doesn't register the changes. Now, what does life form mean in English? According to the latest shorter Oxford English Dictionary, life form in English carries only the biological sense, meaning roughly species. The expression has a fairly technical, biological sense in use when talking about plants or living organisms. The expression life form does not occur in the Oxford English Dictionary before the supplement from 1987, where the first registered use is from 1899, and that quoted text refers explicitly to the German word. So they're talking about the translation from German. Anscombe is not to be ignored, but it is curious. Did she go through all five occurrences? I am not aware of anyone making a reference to this change in translation. But unless her mind had gone, Enscombe must have made a major rethinking of what Wittgenstein could have meant. It seems that a thick lifestyle sense is neither easy to define, nor attached to the word Lebensform, nor easy to translate. It is therefore worth reflecting on whether Wittgenstein and others succeeded in expressing such a sense. Maybe I ought to stress that understanding Lebensform as the English life form does not in itself exclude human affairs from considerations. It opens up for other species. Okay, the conclusion. Enscombe has left readers with a dilemma. When reading the Bilder examples, we have a choice. Either read them as cases about human beings, or read them as cases about other life forms. Whichever way we read them, we have problems. This can be seen if we return to the remark in 19. To imagine a language is to imagine a life form, to use not the old but the new Enscombe translation. Equipped with that, let us return to the Bilders. What are they? Two options. They are human, or they are, say, a kind of very large insect. What are they building? A wall? A house? A hive? Can we see an end to their putting slab on slab? Do they make other moves in their building project? We cannot ask them, for they cannot answer. But we can study them. Do they have blueprints? Do they really have no other words? And if human, do they build? That is, are they builders? Like the carpenter next door? When they stop working for the day, what happens then? Do they freeze up? Or do they just stop talking and walk away, carrying on dumbly? Can both utter the same words? When I try to recall what I previously thought when reading the first remarks as a young student, I draw a blank. I cannot even recall that in my early years as a student we ever made guesses as to what they were doing. How could we have gone into the examples in such great detail and not even have asked that? The first example in the book, the short story, in paragraph 1, is later referred to twice by Wittgenstein, but not referred to as a language game. I believe we, the readers, do look upon it as such. And if anyone sees the fourth case in paragraph 7 as including the shop story as a language game, on the strength of the description given in paragraph 5, that is fine with me. Not realizing that the shop story works as a sleight of hand, it dazzles us. I think the conjuring trick is there. Accepting it as a use of language, we have taken the bait. And when we much later come across the hints in paragraph 130 of how to conceive the language games, how well served by those hints are we in regard to the notions criticized here? Well, 130 talks of our language, not human language, nor just plain language. So there's not much help there. Generally speaking, anything can be compared to any other thing. There are always similarities and dissimilarities. The question to ask is, what telling similarities are there between the example in paragraph 2 and our language? If we cannot see the game in two as a language, then the question is not asked of two objects in the same category. Whatever Wittgenstein later says, the early ways of describing language games lead to mistaken perspective on language, which has been my point here.